Welcome to another episode of Bowel Sounds, the Pediatric GI Podcast, the official podcast of the North American Society of Pediatric Gastroenterology, Hepatology, and Nutrition, or NASPGHAN. My name is Tamara Hajat. I'm a pediatric gastroenterologist at Cincinnati Children's, and I'm joined today by my co-host, Dr. Jason Silverman in Alberta, Canada. Jason, how are you?
I'm well, thanks, Tamara. How are you?
I'm doing good.
Happy New Year. Yes. This is our first episode of 2024.
Yes. We have a good one.
Yes. I can't think of a better way to start 2024. But I'm going to ask you tomorrow, what is a typical New Year's Eve like for you? So are you our all night party rager until 6 a.m. on New Year's Day?
No, you know what? I usually don't celebrate New Year's that much. My sister-in-law loves celebrating New Year's, and she's like brings all the props, and it's usually like a family New Year's thing. But this year I went to Seattle. It was so much fun. So that is kind of my New Year's thing.
Oh, very cool.
How about you?
Yeah. So, I mean, when I was younger, a lot younger, I would go out and party, and it would be a big deal for New Year's Eve.
Either who has a partier? What, Jason?
It sometimes happens. It does. I used to go out, but we get older and I'm married and I have two young kids now. The fun thing now is for listeners that don't know, I live in Edmonton, Alberta, which is mountain time. So what we will often do is we let the kids stay up. My kids are 10 and almost 8. And so we'll let the kids stay up and watch the ball drop in Eastern time zone. So it's 10 p.m. locally, but it's midnight. Yay! Happy New Year! And then they go off to bed. And my wife and I, try and stick it out until real midnight. And it's a little bit quieter. It's a little bit quieter.
Yeah.
How about New Year's resolutions? Are you a New Year's resolution kind of person?
I stopped that a long time ago. I'm like, it never happens. I think I said this last year, it never happens. I try, I put a list, and then I'm like, okay, every year I have the same list, same thing. So I gave up on New Year's resolutions, but I decided that I'm going to do more cat charity work. So I'm now a behavioral therapist for cats.
Certified?
process.
Or do you mean you're just taking in problem cats and trying to sort them out?
Actually, I'm working with Ohio Alley Rescue, OAR, and I just recently joined them as a volunteer there. And they assigned me to the behavioral team. So I'm training feisty cats to be not so feisty so they can find homes.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I have absolutely nothing to match that. I am doing everything I normally do, and that's about all I can deal with. I do deal with the two relatively feisty dogs at home, and that's about all I can manage.
The problem is if I make them more feisty.
That would be a problem. Bring all of your energy to the cats. Ramp them up instead. Well, you know what? Today, as the first episode of the new year, we have a fantastic episode. So many of our listeners will remember the amazing year in review talks that Dr. Bill Balistrieri has done for many years at NASPGHAN. And while he has passed the torch for the year in review, and we recently had Dr. Sandeep Gupta on to do a year in review, we thought it would be great to bring Dr. Balistrieri to Bowel Sounds to cover a bit of a year in review for hepatology topics. So liver-specific topics, some really interesting stuff that's come out over the last year. And honestly, what better way could you have to kick off 2024 than to have Dr. Balistrieri on Bowel Sounds?
I know. Isn't it amazing? I mean, I loved his year in review talks. And it's always funny. The slides are so animated, so much great information. And I don't know if anybody doesn't know Dr. Balistrieri, but who Ever doesn't know him, need to get to know him, but he is Dr. William Balistrieri is a professor in pediatrics. He is the director of Pediatric Liver Care Center. He's a medical director of liver transplantation, and he's a program director of the Transplant Hepatology Fellowship Program at Cincinnati Children's in Cincinnati, Ohio. He is an amazing physician, very smart, very approachable, so nice. He even invites everybody to his house. Everybody that that visits Cincinnati, he invites to his house. You have to listen to the episode to know how. So we are so excited to have him on this episode. And so much exciting information. You have to listen to this one.
Absolutely. So with nothing else to add,
on to the show. Dr. Balistrieri, welcome to Bowel Sounds. We're very excited to have you today. This is actually your second time on Bowel Sounds. Every time, we're very excited to have you.
Well,
so welcome.
I'll get it right this time.
So the question that we'll start with is, how would you describe yourself in one sentence for our listeners who would be really odd if they don't know you? I mean, I think you're very, you're really well known and everybody knows you, but how would you like to describe yourself?
Well, probably best to say I'm a, quote, recovering gastroenterologist, unquote, now focused on loving the liver.
Oh.
Excellent.
Why are you a recovering gastroenterologist?
Yeah, I still get the urge every once in a while, but luckily my support team keeps me away.
So you're like, I really like lumen, but trying to love the liver.
Exactly.
This is definitely a new question to you. So we hear from Tamara all the time about Cincinnati and stuff to do in Cincinnati, but if we were to ask you and people were coming for a visit in Cincinnati who've never been there before, what's something that we should be doing, seeing, eating? What's your go-to recommendation?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the fact that I've been here almost 50 years suggests that there's a lot here. So my suggestions would be my three favorite things. Number one, stop by Children's Hospital, come into the liver clinic. We can then walk over to the zoo, which is very close. And then for the third, you come over to my house and have my wife cook a great dinner.
Oh, wow.
Sounds great.
Is your wife going to like all these invitations, though?
You know her. Becky loves people. She knows more.
She does. I love Becky.
She's a gastroenterologist than I do.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Becky's always involved with all the functions and all of that. And she's amazing. She's amazing. So you said you're a recovering gastroenterologist and you're working on loving the liver. So for non-hepatologists and trainees in our audience, how would you explain your passion for hepatology and what really interests you in the liver?
Well, it's interesting. You know, there was no grand plan for a group to study liver disease in children and adolescents. So it really evolved as a clinical and a research discipline, sort of organically, to use that trite term, because there was no single linear pathway. But of course, de facto, this tree branch sprung from the trunk of pediatric gastroenterology, because as early as, when I started in the field, the elements were there, but they really weren't focused or noticed until individuals ventured deeper into that forest. But for me personally, it was really a few very early clinical experiences that stimulated and in fact continue to stimulate and drive my interest. And I'd be happy to share those with you, if I may.
Yeah, please do.
Yeah, we'd love to hear that.
Well, it's really as an intern, I was assigned to, quote, figure out, unquote, the cause of a severe metabolic disease in an infant with hypoglycemia, elevated liver enzymes. And so, I diligently worked through the case and really initiated my interest in the complex synthetic metabolic pathways in the liver. And then more importantly, the experiments of nature that occur when these pathways go wrong. And that's really been the theme for the last, I don't know, 40, 50 years. And then probably even more devastating was, as a faculty member at CHOP, that was in the mid-70s, over a two-year period, 11 of my patients with biliary atresia died of end-stage liver disease. Now, remember, these were the days before liver transplant. And at the same time, equally frustrating was the group of infants with what was called, quote, idiopathic neonatal hepatitis, terrible term, because the exact nature of those cases was enigmatic. So the challenge that I saw was, how can we demystify and delineate the exact cause of these forms of cholestasis, and what can we do about it? And I told you I was interested in liver metabolism. So I started looking at the pathways and hoped that we could focus on undiscovered inborn errors in a fundamental physiologic process involved in liver function, and especially generating bile flow, a genetic defect in bile acid transport, biosynthesis, or detoxification, with the reasoning that if we could understand that, elucidate the nature, we could allow a not only better understanding of liver function and physiology, but lead to better treatment strategies. So that's the story. That's how it all got started.
That's fascinating.
Pretty, yeah. Pretty good story.
Yeah.
I think you've made a pitch.
Yeah. Now we'll have more people applying for hepatology.
That's great. That's great. We still haven't solved all those mysteries. So,
but there's a lot that it's been solved, and that's what we're going to talk about today. It's so exciting.
Yeah, that's been a great couple of years.
For sure. So I guess on that note, you know, today we're kind of doing a bit of a year in review in the hepatology world. So, you know, we talked to Dr. Sandeep Gupta at NASPGHAN for a GI year in review, and consciously we didn't really cover any hepatology topics in that because we really wanted to have you on to talk about the year in review from a liver point of view. We felt like maybe you're comfortable doing a year in review kind of discussion. You might have done it once or twice before. You know, obviously your talks at NASPGHAN are legend and were always very much enjoyed by us and everyone who knows you and has seen you deliver those talks at NASPGHAN. So maybe with that in mind, we'll get started. And so it's a little bit of a potpourri. So we're going to be moving from topic to topic. We're not necessarily following on any single theme other than that they all revolve around the liver. So we're going to start with two drugs that are classified as ileal bile acid transport inhibitors, and they're specifically designed for the treatment of cholestatic pruritus. So maralixibat and odevixibat, which were first approved in 2021. To treat that cholestatic pruritus due to Alagille syndrome in patients more than 12 months of age. And then this year, maralixibat received expanded FDA approval down to 3 months of age. So could you tell us a little bit more about these medications, you know, how they work, who they're for, how they're used, and are there any essential contraindications or side effects that we need to be aware of?
Yeah, this has been a major story over the last few years, and that is inhibition of the ileal bile acid transporter, because this represents a new therapeutic pathway for the treatment of cholestatic pruritus, and in my opinion, cholestasis in general. So these drugs were approved for Alagille syndrome and PFIC, as you mentioned. The problem has been traditionally treatment of cholestasis, as well as these complications such as pruritus, involved off-label use of a number of drugs with variable benefits, ursodeoxycholic acid, antihistamines, rifampin, opioid agonists, bile acid sequestrants. So there had to be a better way. So we know for sure that in all these disorders, Alagille and PFIC, there is impaired bile flow, similar to what we projected 40 years ago, which leads to elevated serum bile acids, which likely contributes to the pruritus, although I'll be the first to tell you the precise mechanism of pruritus is still incompletely understood. However, the fact that bile acids play a role is supported by the benefit, the antipruritic benefit seen in patients who undergo what we used to do, a surgical biliary diversion. that surgery interrupts the enteropathic circulation and reabsorption of bile acids in the terminal ileum. So what these drugs do is these IBAT inhibitors, they reduce the uptake of bile acids in the ileum, reduce the serum bile acid levels, increase fecal excretion, and lower portal venous and levels of bile acids. So it's basically a medical biliary diversion. So you get the benefit without the surgery. And now approval of these drugs, especially the first mirlixabat for Alagille, was based on a pivotal iconic trial published in Lancet. This was a well-designed placebo-controlled randomized withdrawal period phase 2B study. And this study demonstrated 31 or so patients significant and durable reductions in itch and serum bile acid levels, as well as improvements in serum cholesterol, the cutaneous xanthomas, pediatric quality of life measures, and height Z-scores. So clearly showed some benefit, and all of us were anxious to incorporate this into our clinical practice. So you asked about any adverse effects. Well, you're dumping bile acids into the colon, and bile acids are good cathartic. So you have to be aware of diarrhea, although in both the clinical trials, it was noted to be mild and transient. And then certainly in my experience using these drugs, it's the same. Now, every time I would talk to a family, I'd say, you know, I don't want to find out 5 years from now that beyond the itch, there may be a benefit of getting the bile acid pool size and reduced. And indeed, just a couple of weeks ago, Ron Sokol, another former Cincinnatian, Tamara, published a study that looked at the outcomes of their clinical trial data from the pharmaceutical company. 76 patients, 3 clinical trials with up to 6 years of follow-up. And they looked at the degree of pruritus. About 65% had an improvement in pruritus and same improvement in bilirubin and a reduction in serum bile acid levels. But the thing that was striking is at 6 years, those patients who had a clinically meaningful reduction in pruritus, and we all use a scoring system called ItchRO, it's a 4-point scale. If they had a greater than 1-point reduction, they had significant liver event-free survival, 88 to 90% versus 57%, as well as in serum bilirubin levels. So clearly a long-term impact. So again, this not only seems to improve the quality of life, reduce the itching, but certainly may be a beneficial long-term effect. And the same, yeah. Similar, I could quote similar data for PFIC, for odevixibat, the point is these drugs work.
Yeah. It's rare in any field in medicine that you have a therapy come on the scene that is a real like game changer that completely changes how you manage either a group of symptoms or a condition. And the IBAT inhibitors really seem like that kind of therapy where it's a complete game changer for these kids that had such miserable quality of life due to itch.
Yeah, and certainly it allows me to have some optimism when I tell the families, you know, because in many patients, certainly with Alagille syndrome, they have relatively stable liver function, but the pruritus is so intractable and persistent that these patients are often offered liver transplant. So terrific advance.
That's amazing. Wow. Especially that advancement for kids as well, because I feel like in pediatrics, we have so much limited stuff for kids that once we get something FDA approved for children, it's amazing. It's a great improvement.
Well, you make a good point. You know, this is where pediatric hepatology was leading the field. Usually we take an adult medicine like the antivirals for hepatitis C that have been tested and proven in adults and then extrapolate them down to children. It's just the opposite now. The internists are coming to us and saying, what can we do for our adults with PBC and PSC? And we say, IBAT.
Yeah, yeah. You're welcome.
Fantastic.
But right now we're going to talk about thank you to the adult. Well, we're going to talk about the FDA approved antiviral medicines for hepatitis C, kind of like what you said. These are the direct acting antivirals for hepatitis C, Epclusa and Mavyret.
Mavyret, right.
Mavyret. Okay. I've been practicing these names for a while. And they're the treatment for chronic hepatitis C virus infection in pediatric patients. They've been recently FDA approved. They contain two direct acting antiviral drugs that provide a complete regimen for treating chronic hepatitis C. Epclusa has the... All right, Dr. B, you're gonna have to help me here. The sofosbuvir and velpatasvir. Did I pronounce those right? And the Mavyret has the glecaprevir and piperacillin-tazevir. And these medications are oral, pan-genotypic means that genotypes 1 to 6 for treatment of hepatitis C virus. And they've been recently approved in children as young as 3 years of age. We would love to ask you a few more questions to give us a more insight about what are the efficacies of these medications? What are the indications? Is there a minimum weight? Any contraindications? And if you can tell us a little bit about the kind of the dose, the frequency, how long would you treat these patients for, and the cure rate for hepatitis C?
Well, you know, this is really simple. In fact, we've been working with two state organizations in Kentucky and West Virginia so that primary care providers, nurse practitioners can actually do the prescribing because it's really, really simple. And it's also highly effective. This is a disease that we can cure, period. The published cure rates in clinical trials range from about 95 to 100%. But in clinical practice, if they adhere, it's really hovering very, very close to 100%.
Cure rate.
Highly effective.
Wow.
They are oral. The dose is weight-based. And in our studies, when we got these studies underway, we actually did pharmacokinetics. And so we have good data on dose, weight-based dosing. And most of the children, since they're over 3, it's a question of are they over 17 kilos, under 17 kilos, and then we give the appropriate weight-based dosing. Both medications are available in fixed drug combinations, either as tablets or as granules. So for the very young children, we offer the family to give these medications as granules on a, you know, with pudding or yogurt or whatever. And the side effects are very minimal in all of our studies. And we studied between the two drugs, well over 400 patients. Side effects were very minimal. You know, typical childhood illnesses, there were no adverse reactions. So I encourage, first of all, detect the cases. Our biggest problem right now is case detection. And in fact, as you may know, just last month, the CDC came out with two new recommendations, and that is, number one, HCV testing using HCV RNA of all perinatally exposed infants at age 2 to 6 months. Now, remember, the AAP says 18 months. Well, no, you can accurately diagnose with HCV RNA at age 2 to 6 months. And then the second recommendation, and it's going to impact everybody listening, is the second recommendation is if the patient is positive, detectable HCV RNA, refer them to a healthcare provider with expertise in hepatitis C management. That's everyone, gastroenterologists, and even primary care. So it's going to have an impact. But these are terrific drugs. We can use the word cure.
That's fantastic.
That's amazing. And can I ask you a question? What's the prevalence of a hepatitis C in the United States?
Well, in our area of the Cincinnati, Kentucky, West Virginia, I don't know about Jason's area. We are, because of the opioid epidemic, we are in a very high risk area. Study done here in Cincinnati by Children's Hospital pediatricians. If the mother ever had or is currently using, the incidence is anywhere from 1 to 6% of these babies will be HCV RNA positive. So it's not an excuse to say that it's a rare disease. I would think that in our area, it's about 1 to 2% of the adult population.
Wow. Wow. So we can detect it as early as 2 months, and we can give the medicine as early as 3 years. Is that correct?
Correct. Correct. And you say, well, there's a gap there. Why detect early? Well, number one, these kids are moving from house to house. Many of them are in foster care. Right. And number two, it's important if they are in a foster setting that you make sure the family understands what they're up against. This isn't a disease that's going to be fatal by 3 years of age. And in fact, there is a spontaneous cure rate of about maybe about 20%. So it's important to recognize. That's my bang on the drum for the day.
Can I ask you a question? So is it a lifelong treatment that you need to cure it with? Like,
No, I'm sorry. These drugs, Mavyret is given for 8 weeks only. Wow. And Epclusa is 12 weeks and once a day. So then they're done. They're cured.
Amazing. And then you check the RNA and
it's clear? What we typically do to keep it simplified, we have the HCV RNA at baseline. We obtain it at the end of treatment. And then to understand what's called sustained virologic response, SVR, we check it again 8 to 12 weeks after treatment is ended.
Do you ever check it later in life?
If they did not have any evidence of fibrosis, mm-hmm. which would have put them at risk for liver cancer, I have been seeing them at 1 year after treatment. But the strategy is they're done. They're gone.
Wow. It's done. Amazing.
You know, compared to nearly a year of treatment and poor rates of success, again, we're starting the episode with the feel-good part of hepatology, where we're changing the game with treating some of these conditions.
No question. Yeah, the pegylated interferon is an experience that I know I'm going to have to account for when I get to heaven.
Oh, dear. So maybe we'll stay on the hepatitis theme, but we'll switch gears a little bit and maybe venture into some of that unsolved territory. But last year, around April of 2022, so early in 2022, there started to be several reported cases of this severe acute hepatitis all around the world. It was in the UK, there was reports out of the US and in other countries. And this got everyone's attention. And we actually had Dr. Henry Hsiao on for a special episode in May of last year to cover what we knew at the time. And in all of these conditions, all of these cases, rather, the common hepatotropic viruses, so hepatitis A, B, C, D, E, they'd all been ruled out in the cases. And there was some suggestion relatively early in the course of understanding about these cases that maybe adenovirus could play a role or other viral agents like SARS-CoV-2. Some cases were severe enough to require liver transplantation. And in the end, we had case reports from over 35 countries. More than half were in Europe. And primarily, they were occurring in children under the age of 6. So that's the story as of a year and a half ago. But what have we learned since then? What's the update about this sort of prop, if you will, of acute hepatitis in children?
Yes, thank you, Jason. Yeah, this was one of those events where, you know, just when you think you know it all, you realize you don't know anything. Because we started seeing here in Cincinnati, in fact, these cases, and the case definition was a patient with high levels of ALT, AST, less than 16 years of age, the quote, usual suspects, unquote, were ruled out. And we started to see a spate, not just here, but reported in Birmingham, Alabama, Birmingham, United Kingdom. So you're right. In early 2022, CDC sent an alert saying all U.S. healthcare providers, if you see, look for it. If you see it, report these cases of what was called hepatitis of unknown etiology to public health officials. You know, so what was different? Well, certainly liver failure and acute hepatitis has been around forever. What was new was the fact that these cases seemed to cluster. And we certainly saw that here in Cincinnati. Anna Peters published our data in the Journal of Pediatrics just a few months ago when we looked at our cases. And indeed, we saw a spate of cases. And we also noted that our cases in our center had increased in the period of 2021 to May of 2022 compared to the previous 5 years. And many of the cases, not all, were associated with adenovirus. The good news was only a very small percent required liver transplant. So the question was, what was the cause? And, you know, all these postulates started to come out, certainly adenovirus or maybe a modified adenovirus, human adenovirus with altered characteristics, because typically that virus doesn't cause this kind of injury. Secondly, was the idea that this occurred during COVID, and was there increased susceptibility during the pandemic? These children were not getting into communities or daycare centers, schools where, so they had lower level of virus exposure. Or was the detection of adenovirus merely coincidental, or was it synergistic with, as you mentioned, Jason, SARS-CoV-2? Because we know severe hepatitis can be part of the MIS-C syndrome. Or was this a new agent, a new toxin, a new drug? My theory in many ways was increased awareness, because I was getting calls from community pediatricians saying, you know, I heard about this and therefore, I checked liver enzymes on this child with flu-like symptoms, and they were elevated. So that was always the puzzle. But early this year, three studies were published in Nature that independently linked adeno-associated virus to this entity. Now, what is this? AAV2, that's a virus that's known to replicate in the liver, but does not known to cause hepatitis unless the patient is severely immune-suppressed. So the question, and unfortunately still isn't answered, is the disease rooted in an abnormal immune response, or is it in a patotoxic role now, a new role for this AAV2? And of course, we always have to underline potential genetic susceptibility, and there were some HLA associations. Now, it's not an academic question, it's a relevant question, because it's important to distinguish between immune-mediated and hepatotoxic effects, because it would inform management. Do we use immune suppression or do we use directed antiviral drugs? So that's where we stand. But I have to tell you, the disease has not disappeared. In fact, in clinic on Wednesday, I saw two siblings that had presented in late October, early November with the syndrome, high AST, high ALT. Both were positive for adenovirus. Both, I'm knocking on wood, are recovering. So that's the story.
I think this had a lot of people scratching their head. I know we did a journal club where we reviewed some of the early case series, and you know, we were dutifully reporting all of our local cases as requested that met criteria. But it was still very much one of these things where we were also second guessing whether this was truly, as you said, Dr. Balistrieri, was this a new phenomenon or a newly, more accurately recognized phenomenon that existed before? So it's really interesting to hear more maybe pathogenesis information or data that might suggest what's really going on.
Right. So maybe next year when I'm on for the third time, we'll have more information.
You'd have to get your jacket ready.
I'm getting the jacket ready.
Well, now we're going to talk about what we originally thought was a benign condition. We didn't really think much about it, but now we think it might be a good thing to have this. And I was very fascinated. Drum roll, it is Gilbert syndrome.
This is, you know, and I've seen children with Gilbert syndrome for many, many years. It's very common. And you know, we'd always try to tell the families, you know, it's no big deal. But when they look at a child that's jaundiced or a child getting a little ridiculed, you say, what's going on? Well, now there's a new view of Gilbert syndrome, a new view of bilirubin.
People are going to wish they had Gilbert.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's because several studies that were published just in June of this year suggest a very vital role of unconjugated bilirubin as a fierce antioxidant and anti-inflammatory.
Better than blueberries.
Yes, exactly. And it's interesting because, as I mentioned, this is a common disease. But we always had some difficulty convincing families not to worry. We know the mechanism, and I'd be happy to review that with you if you like. And it's a diagnosis of exclusion. So these kids go through a significant workup usually, including often genetic assessment, which is really not necessary. But what these studies that were published in the journal Hepatology and in Science did was they emphasized the potential beneficial antioxidant effects of UCB, unconjugated bilirubin, citing the multiple intracellular signaling pathways affected by that molecule. So they postulate that subjects with Gilbert's may benefit from that mild hyperbilirubinemia. And I've quoted them many times, quote, they are protected from diseases of civilization, such as cardiovascular disease, certain cancers, autoimmune or neurodegenerative disease. And in fact, there are some clinical trials that are now designed to iatrogenically increase serum unconjugated bilirubin levels. In other words, an induced Gilbert syndrome using nanoparticles to deliver UCB to tissue. And they say that this may be an option to treat inflammatory metabolic disease and cancer. So clearly a beneficial role of mildly elevated serum bilirubin, perhaps in aging. So if you see me walking around the hospital looking a little yellow, don't worry.
Does it help with like wrinkles and
I'm not gonna overemphasize it, but it's a nice story to tell our families.
This is a very cool story. When I first read about this during preparation for this episode, I thought this is fantastic. Like, this is natural selection at work, right? Why else was this condition propagating? What's the value add to have this around? And now you may be seeing it. So maybe this is going to become the dominant strain of humans, 1,000 years from now.
Beautiful.
So next up, we have another emerging therapy to talk about, and this time it's for alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency.
Yeah.
So here's my turn to stumble over a name. So
Fazisiran? You can say anything.
Fazisiran?
We're all going to get it wrong.
Okay, Fazisiran.
I'd probably say it like Fazisiran.
Yeah. So anyway, this drug, which is an RNA interference therapeutic.
Right.
I think I have that right. And
that's correct.
And so maybe I'll just turn it over. And can you tell us a little bit about what this is about? Because this is an agent that's actually finally directed at the underpinning pathogenesis of alpha-1 antitrypsin.
Yeah, exactly. And I was very excited to see this and to talk to the people who were doing the investigations. Because with alpha-1 antitrypsin liver disease, what happens is the mutated alpha-1, the Z protein, accumulates in the liver, and that sets off a cascade of events that result in significant liver injury, fibrosis, and liver cancer. And we really haven't had much in the way of therapy other than liver transplant. Now, this is totally different from alpha-1 lung disease, which, you know, you're talking about loss of function, where you don't have alpha-1 to protect the lungs, versus a gain of function where you got all this alpha-1 accumulating. So what this drug does, as you're right, it's an RNA interference therapeutic. And there was a study reported, just one study published, there are some abstracts, reported a randomized placebo-controlled phase 2 trial with the endpoint after they gave this molecule to look at the liver content of the Z protein, ZAT, as well as liver tests. And clearly this drug reduced the liver Z alpha-1 synthesis. It shut off the synthesis, of both normal and abnormal protein. It decreased the amount of globules of alpha-1 that accumulated in the liver and improved the histology in patients. Now, granted, it was a small number of adults with alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, but nevertheless, very promising. And I'm looking forward to even deeper, broader studies in a wide range of patients, including children.
So stay tuned. This is still a story in evolution.
No question. But again, a cause for optimism Because once again, you know, we've been saying to families, we can't do much about it, but maybe now we can, or maybe we will be able to.
Oh, fantastic. So maybe by the time NASPGHAN 2025 comes around, we'll be hearing more about this.
Yeah. So that would be bowel sounds number four. For
at that time, we'll definitely have to have the jacket ready. No question.
Sorry to keep inviting myself.
It's all right.
Well, there's this, we're going to talk about what really was maybe optimistic in the past, but really now is available. We all know that early detection of biliary atresia is really, really important. And we depended on kind of serum bilirubins and direct bilirubin. But there's something right now, the MMP7, that is available now for possibly early detection in 3 days of life. So the matrix metalloproteinase 7. Right. And we did talk briefly to Dr. Bazera about this last year on Bowel Sounds. I even asked him, I was like, this is so amazing. Is this something that we can check in utero even before the baby is born out of like the amniotic fluid? There is a pilot study in JPGN that showed that the MMP7 DBS analysis can distinguish biliary atresia from other conditions as early as 3 days of age. So what can you tell us about how this is implemented nowadays and what the future for it is?
Well, you know, it's tough to predict where it's going to go, but certainly in our hands, you know, as you mentioned, George Bazea developed this here based on very sound molecular biology to understand what was elevated in patients with biliary atresia. And he established with his team's cutoffs, and we use it very, very frequently because the cutoffs, you know, it's really quite clear that this is a very elevated levels consistent with biliary atresia or in a patient with jaundice, and it's not that elevated. And you're right, the study that you cited in JPGN suggests that can be done as part of the newborn screening, because I think that's where the money is going to be. We need to detect this disease early, because if we're not getting them into a Kasai by ideally 30 days of age, the outcomes diminish. So this will join serum bile acids, serum bilirubin levels, as you know, from Sunny Harpavath in Houston, and the MMP7 as early screening techniques, which will hopefully be incorporated as time goes on. That's our dream.
Wow, that's fantastic. Because like you said, there's that time imperative to make that diagnosis as early as possible. And, you know, I was always taught within 60 days, but you're right. The centers with the best outcomes, it's even 30 days. And the earlier we can get them into Kasai, the better. So
exactly.
So really exciting. Can't wait to have this more broadly available. I'm going to switch gears again. And we've been talking about all these positive medication stories. And I'm going to bring up maybe at least a question of a negative medication story. And, you know, there's been a longstanding understanding that methotrexate, which is used to treat a variety of conditions, primarily, you know, rheumatologic conditions, but also inflammatory bowel disease, the methotrexate increases the risk of liver disease. But there's been some recent studies that have called this into question. So can you set the record straight? So does methotrexate increase the risk of liver disease?
Yeah, Jason, this is again one of those stories that I was so pleased to see evolved. Back in the days, I was actually attending on the internal medicine service because there weren't a lot of hepatologists. And our major consultation was to do a liver biopsy in a patient with psoriasis or rheumatoid arthritis who was on methotrexate because they were worried that this drug was causing liver injury. Because the longstanding myth was that long-term treatment with methotrexate can be associated with the insidious development of steatosis and fibrosis. So and liver enzymes weren't always reliable. So all these patients were having serial serum ALT and biopsies devised by rheumatologists, dermatologists, along with interval liver biopsies. So we were doing 3 to 4 biopsies a week on just that indication. Well, I was always skeptical because it seemed to me that every time I'd go over and see a patient, they all had other comorbidities. They were obese. They were drinking. They had diabetes, hyperlipidemia. So we said, okay, let's look at children. So with the rheumatologist here at Cincinnati, this was back in the late 70s, early 80s, we did biopsies on all children in their JRA clinic that had been on methotrexate to the tune of 2 grams in their career. And there was no significant histologic changes in those patients. So my mantra was, you know, it's not the drug, it's the patient. And it's a very good drug, still very utilized in RA and other diseases. But this study that really nailed it for me, and I loved it, I was going to call these folks and congratulate them, was entitled Busting the Myth of Methotrexate Chronic Hepatotoxicity. And what they showed was in a healthy individual without obesity, without alcohol intake, without metabolic syndrome, without diabetes, methotrexate is very, very safe. So I know it's used in inflammatory bowel disease, so I think we can safely say that myth has been debunked.
Can you tell us exactly what the risk factors in kids are? So I know like alcoholism and maybe MAFLD in adults are, but when you look at a kid and you want to start methotrexate, when would you say maybe let's not start it to yes, we can start it? And then is there any change in the monitoring of the liver enzymes?
So that these are guidelines that need to be promulgated by NASPGHAN or whomever. But in my opinion, I think if a patient was going to be trialed, I would probably do standard liver tests. I would probably obtain a FibroScan or transient elastography via ARFI or whatever. And I think the risk factor would probably be similar. If they have obesity, metabolic syndrome, type 2 diabetes, I think they would be at higher risk. And the monitoring technique would be the same, probably FibroScan. And even though ALT, AST aren't 100% reliable, I think that they should be monitored. So, but that needs to be promulgated overseen by appropriate guidelines instead of someone still with an axe to grind.
So there's no clear guidelines, but these are
Not to my knowledge, no. Okay. Not that I have seen.
So in the days and age of social media, we have a lot of social media influencers, and they are promoting kind of something to improve physical appearance and muscle mass and athletic performance, which is a quick fix. The selective androgen receptor modulators, the SARMs.
Right.
And the FDA actually recently kind of put out a warning about the use of these SARMs, that they are causing a lot of life-threatening health problems. One of them is like heart attacks, strokes, mental illnesses, sleep disturbances, infertility, but also liver injury and acute liver failure.
Right.
And I think this is a very important topic for gastroenterologists, especially if they come in, if a patient comes in with kind of liver injury or like elevated liver enzymes, to ask about this, but also for pediatricians and hepatologists to know about. So what can you tell us about this?
Well, you said it right. And that is, we need to ask, because this is, you know, you ask, are you on any meds? And people or the child, the adolescent, say, no, not really. Well, they don't consider this perhaps a medication, or they don't talk about it. The studies you quote are, of course, adults, but there are reports in adolescents who have developed significant liver injury due to these SARMs. They are not approved by the FDA, as you say, but they are heavily promoted as alternatives to other androgenic anabolic steroids. There are reports of liver injury. Luckily, in the most recent reports, these are patients that recovered. But the interesting thing is we now know the mechanism. And guess what? It interferes with bile salt export.
Oh, huh. No.
Oh, liver. Yeah. You're not going to get away from that. There is no way.
Do you know?
So it's an interesting, again, talk about an experiment in nature, but they clearly can cause liver injury. So it has these, not just SARMs themselves, but other things that people might take to look better, feel better, get more muscular, other than taking a good dose of unconjugated bilirubin. You need to ask about this.
And are these, so I'm not a bodybuilder. I don't know too much about these. Are they like pills? Are they powder? What are they? Because I think a lot of our patients, when we say, you need to do protein shakes, what we mean is by like Ensure or Pediasure, or, and state that to them, but I don't know if they, if some patients are like, when somebody says protein shakes, they go and do like the powdered protein. So are these powders, pills, or?
Well, again, I wouldn't advise you to go online and type it in, because, you know, it's an interesting topic for many ways, but you know, anything you want is available. Pills, liquids, powders, supplements, et cetera. It's a massive market. So we just, my point is we just need, as you said, to be aware and ask about this.
Right.
Really important to, like you say, this wouldn't be considered a medication. And also probably the teenagers who might be taking this, their parents may not be aware that they're taking this. So this is yet again something to bring up during your one-on-one with your teen or adolescent patient, with mom and dad out of the room, just to get the straight story. So this has been a really phenomenal overview of some really hot topics over the last year. I think you've done a really good job of sowing the seeds for a third visit later on with a few unresolved questions that we'll have to have you back to talk about some more.
Maybe you'll invite us and we'll go and visit you. Jason will be in Cincinnati. You'll invite us to Becky's wonderful food. And we will sit around the dinner table with our microphones and talk about all the new things that are available in hepatology world.
Sign me up.
If I could ask you to, as a way of wrapping this up a little bit, what would you say are sort of three takeaways that you want our listeners to come away with after this episode?
Oh, sure. Well, number one, be a liver lover, even if it's a one-night stand. we need all the help we can get, because we need extra effort to prevent liver disease in early life, as we talked about. Thoughtful medical management with some of these new tools, precise decision-making, again, with MMP7 and so on, and then continuous, conscientious, creative, and courageous use of non-transplant options, so we don't have to bring these children to transplant. You know, you've probably heard me say it many times, we got to save livers and save lives from not transplant. But the other point, specifically, we can cure hepatitis C, but we need to find the cases. Yes. And there's clearly hope for novel strategies to diagnose and treat children with cholestasis. Yeah. So I guess that's more than three, but that would be my summation and soapboxing.
That's a great wrap up.
Yeah, very great. So we're coming to our last question, and I always like this question because there's always great advice that comes out of this question. So Dr. B, looking back at your career, what has been the most valuable advice that you received, or you maybe think about every day or a lot and say, this is a great advice that I've received? And what advice would you give to our listeners?
Whoa, boy, we got another hour. You know, simple things. You know, I coach youth lacrosse, and at all levels, you know, we can tell them, you know, you got to focus, you got to persevere, and you've got to commit and respect what you're doing. And that applies across all professions and all activities. But for our field specifically, I guess I love Einstein's original quote, never lose a holy curiosity. In other words, in your busy day, give yourself time to learn and look through this very rich literature. We've heard about today, that's just 1 year's worth of literature focused on just one organ. So give yourself time to learn. And therefore, you can always be on the lookout for exciting new opportunities, collaborations, and more importantly, new strategies for your patients. And then finally, I guess you said advice given to me, Bill Schubert, who I know you know about, maybe Jason's heard about it. He was my mentor, and it's still relevant what he said. He said, patients and parents won't care how much you know until they know how much you care.
That's true. That's
great advice.
That's absolutely true. I think everybody just wants to feel like they're heard and that you actually don't just dismiss them, that you just address and hear their concerns, regardless of how big or small they are.
I forgot who said it. Probably one of my parents said, you know, God gave you 2 ears and 1 mouth. Use them in that ratio.
That's a good one. Well, Dr. Yep. B, this was great. It's always great to talk to you. So much knowledge. I wish we can have you every single episode.
I think the audience would quickly get tired, but it's been fun, and you had some great questions. So thank you for letting me share these developments, and we'll see you next January.
Yes, next year.
Thanks again, Dr. Barilla-Suri. That's great.
Thank you, Jason. Thank you.
Well, Jason, that was amazing. What was the most interesting for you?
Well, I thought it was really cool. I remember when you sent me the article link, the fact that everyone is going to want just a little bit of Gilbert. Maybe it'll be good for them. I thought that was a really interesting, interesting topic.
I was like, antioxidants, cool. I'm not going to have wrinkles anymore. Maybe I want Gilbert.
Everyone is going to be yellow and happy.
Yes, exactly. So if you don't already, be sure to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Bowel Sounds and on Facebook at Pediatric GI Podcast for the latest news and updates on upcoming episodes. If you like what you heard and want to support the podcast, it would really help us if you did one or all of the following three things. Well, actually following four things now. One, tell one person about the podcast. Two, leave a review on Apple Podcasts to help others discover our podcast. Three, on our Buzzsprout page, there's a link to support the show by making a donation to the NASPGHAN Foundation. You can also get there through www.nasbghan.org. And four, go and buy our merch. It's amazing. There's mugs, there's magnets, t-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, all of that. That's great. And the Absolutely. Link is in the show notes.
For sure. And as always, the discussion, views, and recommendations of this podcast are the sole responsibility of the host and guest and are subject to change with advances in the field.
Thank you all for listening.
Bye. Bye-bye.